Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC. Used with permission.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Chapter 11, Part 1 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Ship of Horror, Part 1. Quest leaned a little forward and gazed down the line of steamer chairs. The professor, in a borrowed overcoat and cap, was reclining at full length, studying a book on seagulls which he had found in the library. Laura and Lenora were both dozing tranquilly. Mr. Harris of Scotland Yard was deep in a volume of detective stories. "As a pleasure cruise," Quest remarked grimly, "this little excursion seems to be a complete success." Laura opened her eyes at once. "Trying to get my goat again, huh?" she retorted. "I suppose that's what you're after. Going to tell me, I suppose, that it wasn't Craig I saw aboard this steamer?" "We're all liable to make mistakes," Quest observed, "and I am inclined to believe that this is one of yours." Laura's expression was a little dogged. "If he's too clever for you and Mr. Harris," she said, "I can't help that. I only know that he came on board. My eyes are the one thing in life I do believe." "If you'll excuse my saying so, Miss Laura," Harris ventured, leaning deferentially towards her, "there isn't a passenger on board this ship, or a servant, or one of the crew, whom we haven't seen. We've been in every stateroom, and we've even searched the hold. We've been over this ship backwards and forwards. The captain's own steward has been our guide, and we conducted an extra search on our own account. Personally, I must say that I have come to the same conclusion as Mr. Quest. At the present moment, there is no such person as the man we are looking for on board this steamer." "Then either changed on to another one," Laura declared obstinately, "or else he jumped overboard." Harris, who was a very polite man, gazed thoughtfully seaward. Quest smiled. "When Laura's set on a thing," he remarked, "she takes a little moving. What do you think about it, Professor?" The professor laid down his book, keeping his finger in the place. He had the air of a man perfectly content with himself and his surroundings. "My friend," he said, "I boarded this steamer with only one thought in my mind, Craig. At the present moment, I feel myself compelled to plead guilty to a complete change of outlook. The horrors of the last few months seem to have passed from my brain like a dream. I lie here. I watch these white-winged birds wheeling around us. I watch the sunshine make jewels of the spray. I breathe this wonderful air. I relax my body to slow, soothing movements of the boat, and I feel a new life stealing through me. Is Craig really on board? Was it really he who Miss Laura here saw? At the present moment, I really do not care. I learned from the steward, who arranged my bath this morning, that we are bound for India. I am very glad to hear it. It is some time since I saw Bombay, and the thought of these long days of complete peace fills me with a most indescribable satisfaction." Quest grunted a little as he knocked the ash from his cigar. "Not much of the bloodhound about the professor," he remarked. "What about you, Lenora?" She smiled at him. "I agree entirely with the professor," she murmured, "except that I'm not quite so sure that I appreciate the rhythmic movement of the boat as he seems to. For the rest, I have just that feeling that I would like to go on and forget all the horrible things that have happened, to live in a sort of dream, and wake up in a world from which Craig had vanished altogether." "Enervating effect this voyage seems to be having upon all of you," Quest grumbled. "Even Harris there looks far too well contented with life." The detective smiled. He was young and fresh-colored, with a shrewd but pleasant face. He glanced involuntarily at Laura as he spoke. "Well, Mr. Quest," he said, "I didn't bring you on the steamer, so I don't feel any responsibility about it. But I must confess that I am enjoying the trip. I haven't had a holiday this year." Quest struggled to his feet and threw back the rug in his chair. "If you all persist in turning this into a pleasure cruise," he remarked, "I suppose I'll have to alter my own point of view. Come on, Harris. You and I promised to report to the captain this morning. I don't suppose he'll be any too pleased with us. Let's get through with it." The two men walked down the deck together. They found the captain alone in his room, with a chart spread out in front of him and a pair of compasses in his hand. He turned round and greeted them. "Well?" "No luck, sir," Quest announced. "Your steward has given us every assistance possible, and we have searched the ship thoroughly. Unless he has found a hiding place unknown to your steward, and not apparent to us, the man is not on board." The captain frowned slightly. "You are not suggesting that it is possible, I suppose?" Quest did not reply at once. He was thinking of Laura's obstinacy. "Personally," he admitted, "I should not have believed it possible. The young lady of our party, however, who declares that she saw Craig board the steamer, is quite immovable." The captain rose to his feet. He was a man of medium height, strongly built, with short brown beard and keen blue eyes. "The matter must be cleared up entirely," he declared brusquely. "If you'll excuse me for a moment, I will talk to the young lady and myself." He walked firmly down the deck to where the two girls were seated and paused in front of Laura. "So you're the young lady," he remarked, touching his cap, "who thinks that I come to sea with criminals stowed away on my ship?" "I don't know what your habits are, Captain," Laura replied, "but this particular criminal boarded your ship all right in Southampton Harbor." "Anything wrong with your eyesight?" the captain inquired blandly. "No," Laura assured him. "I saw the man. Saw him just as plainly as I see you now." "Do you know," the captain persisted, "that Mr. Quest and Mr. Harris have searched every nook and corner of the ship? They have had an absolutely free hand, and my own steward has been their guide. They have seen every man, boy, woman, and animal amongst my crew or passengers." "They've been fooled somehow," Laura muttered. The captain frowned. He was on the point of a sharp rejoinder when he met Laura's eyes. She was smiling very faintly, and there was something in her expression which changed his whole point of view. "I'll go and make a few inquiries myself," he declared. "See you at dinner time, I hope, young ladies." "If you keep her steady as this," Laura promised, "there are hopes." He disappeared along the deck and presently re-entered his room, where Harris and Quest were waiting for him. He was followed by his steward, an undersized man with pallid complexion and nervous manner. He closed the door behind him. "Brown," he said, turning to the steward, "I understand you to say that you have taken these gentlemen into every corner of the ship, that you have ransacked every possible hiding place, that you have given them every possible opportunity of searching for themselves." "That is quite true, sir," the man acknowledged. "You agree with me that it is impossible for anyone to remain hidden in this ship?"
"Absolutely, sir."
"You hear, gentlemen," the captain continued, "I really can do no more. It is perfectly clear to me that the man you are seeking is not on my ship. Your very charming young lady friend seems to think it impossible that she could have been mistaken. But as a matter of fact, she was. If I might take the liberty, Mr. Quest, I would suggest that you ask her, at any rate, to keep her suspicions to herself."
"I'll see she doesn't talk," Quest promised. "Very sorry to have given you all this trouble, I'm sure."
"It's no trouble," the captain replied, "and apart from the disagreeable nature of your business, I am delighted to have you on board. If you can forget your suspicions about this fellow Craig, I should do my best to make your trip a pleasant one as far as Port Said, or on to India if you decide to take the trip with me."
"Very good of you, Captain, I'm sure," Quest pronounced. "We shall go on keeping our eyes open, of course, but apart from that, we'll forget the fellow."
The captain nodded. "I am coming down to dinner tonight," he announced, "and shall hope to find you in your places. What the mischief are you hanging about for, Brown?" he asked, turning to the steward, who was standing by with a carpet sweeper in his hand.
"Room wants cleaning out badly, sir."
The captain glanced distastefully at the carpet sweeper.
"Do it when I'm at dinner, then," he ordered, "and take that damn thing away."
The steward obeyed promptly. Quest and Harris followed him down the deck.
"Queer-looking fellow, that," the latter remarked. "Doesn't seem quite at his ease, does he?"
"Seems a trifle over-anxious, I thought, when he was showing us round the ship," Quest agreed.
Harris murmured softly. "As the gentleman who wrote the volume of detective stories I am reading puts it, we had better keep our eye on Brown."
The captain, who was down to dinner unusually early, rose to welcome Quest's little party and himself arranged the seats.
"You, Miss Lenora," he said, "will please sit on my left, and you, Miss Laura, on my right. Mr. Quest, will you sit on the other side of Miss Laura, and Mr. Harris two places down on my left? There is an old lady who expects to be at the table, but the steward tells me she hasn't been in yet." They settled down into the places arranged for them. Harris was looking a little glum. Lenora and Quest exchanged a meaning glance.
"I'm not sure that I appreciate this arrangement," Harris whispered to his neighbor.
"You may be candid," Lenora replied, "but you aren't very polite, are you?"
Harris almost blushed as he realized his slip.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but to tell you the truth," he added, glancing towards Quest, "I fancied that you were feeling about the same."
"We women are poor dissemblers," Lenora murmured.
"Do look how angry this old woman seems."
An elderly lady, dressed in somewhat oppressive black, with a big cameo brooch at her throat and a black satin bag in her hand, was being shown by the steward to a seat by Quest's side. She acknowledged the captain's greeting acidly.
"Good evening, Captain," she said. "I understood from the second steward that the seat on your right hand would be reserved for me. I am Mrs. Fostin Rowe."
The captain received the announcement calmly.
"Very pleased to have you at the table, madam," he replied. "As to the seating, I leave that entirely to the steward. I never interfere myself."
Laura pinched his arm, and Lenora glanced away to hide a smile. Mrs. Fostin Rowe studied the menu disapprovingly.
"Hors d'oeuvres," she declared, "I never touch. No one knows how long they've been opened. Bouillon. I will have some bouillon, steward."
"In one moment, madam."
The professor just then came ambling along towards the table.
"I fear that I'm a few moments late," he remarked,
as he took the chair next to Miss Fosden Rowe. "I offer you my apologies, Captain. I congratulate you on your library. I have discovered a most interesting book upon the habits of seagulls. It kept me engrossed until the very last moment."
"Very disagreeable habits, those I've noticed," Miss Fosden Rowe sniffed.
"Madam," the professor assured her, "yours is but a superficial view. For myself, I must confess that the days upon which I learn something new in life are days of happiness for me. Today is an example. I have learned something new about seagulls, and I am hungry."
"Well, you'll have to stay hungry a long time at this table, then," Mrs. Fosden Rowe snapped. "Seems to me that the service is going to be abominable."
The steward, who had just arrived, presented a cup of bouillon to Quest. The others had all been served. Quest stirred it thoughtfully.
"As to the custom," Mrs. Fosden Rowe continued, "of serving gentlemen before ladies, it is, I suppose, peculiar to this steamer."
Quest hastily laid down his spoon, raised a cup of bouillon, and presented it with a little bow to his neighbor.
"Pray allow me, ma'am," he begged. The steward was to blame.
Mrs. Fosden Rowe did not hesitate for a moment. She broke up some toast in the bouillon and commenced to sip it.
"Your politeness will at least teach them a lesson," she said. "I am used to travel by the P&O, and from what I have seen of this steamer..."
The spoon suddenly went clattering from her fingers. She caught at the sides of the table. There was a strange look in her face. With scarcely a murmur, she fell back in her seat. Quest leaned hurriedly forward.
"Captain," he explained, "steward, Miss Fosden Rowe is ill."
There was a slight commotion. The doctor came hurrying up from the other side of the salon. He bent over her, and his face grew grave.
"What is it?" the captain demanded.
The doctor glanced at him meaningly.
"She had better be carried out," he whispered.
It was all done in a moment. There was nothing but Mrs. Fosden Rowe's empty place at the table and the cup of bouillon to remind them of what had happened.
"Was it a faint?" Lenora asked.
"We shall know directly," the captain replied. "Better keep our places, I think. Steward, serve the dinner as usual."
The man held out his hand to withdraw the cup of bouillon, but Quest drew it towards him.
"Let it wait for a moment," he ordered. He glanced at the captain, who nodded back. In a few moments the doctor reappeared. He leaned down and whispered to the captain.
"Dead?"
The captain gave no sign.
"Better call it heart failure," the doctor continued. "I'll let the people know quietly. I don't in the least understand the symptoms, though."
Quest turned around. "Doctor," he said, "I happen to have my chemical chest with me, and some special testing tubes. If you'll allow me, I'd like to examine this cup of bouillon. You might come round, too, if you will."
The captain nodded.
"I'd better stay here for a time," he decided. "I'll follow you presently." The service of dinner was resumed. Laura, however, sent plate after plate away. The captain watched her anxiously.
"I can't help it," she explained. "I don't know whether you've had any talk with Mr. Quest, but we've been through some queer times lately. I guess this death business is getting on my nerves."
The captain was startled. "You don't for a moment connect Mrs. Fosden Rowe's death with the criminal you are in search of?" he exclaimed.
Laura sat quite still for a moment.
"The bouillon was offered first to Mr. Quest," she murmured.
The captain called his steward.
"Where did you get the bouillon you served, that last cup especially?" he asked.
"From the pantry, just as usual, sir," the man answered. "It was all served out from the same cauldron."
"Any chance of anyone getting at it?"
"Quite impossible, sir."
Laura rose to her feet.
"Sorry," she apologized. "I can't eat anything. I'm off on deck."
The captain rose promptly. "I'll escort you if I may," he suggested. Harris, too, rose from his place after a final and regretful glance at the menu, and joined the others. The captain, however, drew Laura's arm through his as they reached the stairs, and Harris, with a little shrug of the shoulders, made his way to Quest's stateroom. The doctor, the professor, Quest, and Lenora were all gathered round two little tubes, which the criminologist was examining with an electric torch. "No reaction at all," the latter muttered. "This isn't an ordinary poison, anyway." The professor, who had been standing on one side, suddenly gave vent to a soft exclamation. "Wait," he whispered. "Wait, I have an idea." End of chapter 11, part 1. Chapter 11, part 2 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Ship of Horror, part 2. He hurried off to his stateroom. The doctor was poring over a volume of tabulated poisons. Quest was still watching his tubes. Lenora sat upon the couch. Suddenly, the professor reappeared. He was carrying a small notebook in his hand. His manner betrayed some excitement. He closed the door carefully behind him. "I want you all," he begged, "to listen very carefully to me. You'll discover the application of what I am going to read when I am finished. Now, if you please." They looked at him wonderingly. It was evident that the professor was very much in earnest. He held the book a little way away from him and read slowly and distinctly. "This," he began, "is the diary of a tour made by Craig and myself in northern Egypt some 14 years ago. Here is the first entry of import. Monday, 29 miles southeast of Port Said. We have stayed for 2 days at a little Mongar village. I have today come to the definite conclusion that anthropoid apes were at one time denizens of this country. Tuesday, both Craig and I have been a little uneasy today. These Mongars, in whose encampment we have found our way, are one of the strangest and fiercest of the nomad tribes. They are descended, without a doubt, from the ancient Mongolians, who invaded this country some 700 years before Christ. They have interbred with the Arabs to some extent, but have preserved, in a marvelous way, their individuality as a race. They have the narrow eyes and the thick nose base of the pure Oriental, also much of his cunning. One of their special weaknesses seems to be the invention of the most hideous forms of torture, which they apply remorselessly to their enemies." "Pleasant sort of people," Quest muttered. "We escaped with our lives," the professor explained earnestly, "from these people only on account of an incident which you will find in the next paragraph. Wednesday. This has been a wonderful day for, as chiefly owing to what I must place on record as an act of great bravery by Craig, my servant. Early this morning, a man-eating lion found his way into the encampment. The Mongars behaved like arrant cowards. They fled right and left, leaving the chief's little daughter, Frida, at the brute's mercy. Craig, who's by no means an adept in the use of firearms, chased the animal as he was making off with the child, and more by good luck than anything else, managed to wound it mortally. He brought the child back to the encampment just as the chief and the warriors of the tribe returned from a hunting expedition. Our position here is now absolutely secure. We are treated like gods, and appreciating my weakness for all matters of science, the chief has today explained to me many of the secret mysteries of the tribe. Amongst other things, he has shown me a wonderful secret poison,
known only to this tribe, which they call Videmzu. It brings almost instant death, and is exceedingly difficult to trace. The addition of sugar causes a curious condensation and resolves it almost to a white paste. The only antidote is a substance which they use here freely, and which is exactly equivalent to our camphor. The professor closed his book. Quest promptly rang the bell. "Some sugar," he ordered, turning to the steward. They waited in absolute silence. The suggestion which the professor's disclosure had brought to them was stupefying. Even Quest's fingers, as a moment or two later, he rubbed two knobs of sugar together so that the particles should fall into the tubes of bouillon, shook. The result was magical. The bouillon turned to a strange shade of gray and began slowly to thicken. "It is the Mongar poison," the professor cried with breaking voice. They all looked at one another. "Craig must be here amongst us," Quest muttered. "And the bouillon," Lenora cried, clasping Quest's arm. "The bouillon was meant for you. There seems to be somehow, amongst all of them, a curious indisposition to discuss this matter." Suddenly Lenora, who was sitting on the lounge underneath the porthole, put out her hand and picked up a card which was lying by her side. She glanced at it, at first curiously, then she shrieked. "A message," she cried, "a message from the hands, look." They crowded around her. In that same familiar handwriting was scrawled across the face of the card these few words: "To Sanford Quest. You have escaped this time by a chance of fortune, not because your wits are keen, not because of your own shrewdness, simply because fate willed it. It will not be for long." Underneath was a drawing of the clenched hands. "There is no longer any doubt," Lenora said calmly. "Craig is on board. He must have been on deck a few minutes ago. It was his hand which placed this card in the porthole. Listen, what's that?" There was a scream from the deck. They all recognized Laura's voice. Harris was out of the stateroom first, but they were all on deck within 10 seconds. Laura was standing with one hand clasping the rail, her hand fiercely outstretched toward the lower part of the promenade deck. Through the darkness they heard the sound of angry voices. "What is it, Laura?" Lenora cried. She swung round upon them. "Craig," she cried, "Craig. I saw his face as I sat in my chair there talking to the captain. I saw a man's white face, nothing else. He must have been leaning over the rail. He heard me call out and he disappeared." The captain came slowly out of the shadows, limping a little, followed by his steward, who was murmuring profuse apologies. "Did you find him?" Laura demanded eagerly. "I did not," the captain replied a little tersely. "I ran into Brown here, and we both had a shake-up." "But he was there a second ago," Laura cried out. "I beg your pardon, miss," Brown ventured, "but the deck's closed at the end, as you can see, with sailcloth, and I was leaning over the rail myself when you shrieked. There wasn't anyone else near me, and no one can possibly have passed round the deck, as you can plainly see for yourself." Laura stood quite still. "What doors are there on the side?" she asked. "The doors of my room only," the captain replied a little shortly. "It was Brown you saw, of course. He was standing exactly where you thought you saw Craig." Laura walked to the end of the deck and back. "Very well, then," she said. "You people had better get a straight waistcoat ready for me. If I didn't see Craig there, I'm going off my head." Quest had disappeared some seconds ago. He came thoughtfully back a little later. "Captain," he asked, "what shall you say if I tell you that I have proof that Craig is on board?" The captain glanced at Laura and restrained himself. "I should probably say a great many things
which I should regret afterwards," he replied grimly. "Sit down, and we'll tell you what has happened in my room," Quest continued. He told the story calmly and without remark. The captain held his head. "Of course I'm convinced that I am a sane man," he said, "but this sounds more like a Muchosen story than anything I've ever heard. I suppose you people are all real." "You are in earnest about this, aren't you? It isn't a gigantic joke." "We are in deadly earnest," the professor pronounced gravely. "I have been down to the pantry," Quest went on. "The porthole has been open all day. It was just possible for a man to have reached the cups of bouillon as they were prepared. That isn't the point, however. Craig is cunning and clever enough for any devilish scheme on earth, and that card proves that he is on board." "The ship shall be searched," the captain declared once more. "We'll look into every crack and every cupboard." Lenora turned away with a little shiver. It was one of her rare moments of weakness. "You won't find him. You won't ever find him," she murmured. "And I'm afraid." Lenora grasped the rails of the steamer and glanced downwards at the great barge full of Arab sailors and merchandise. In the near background were the docks of Port Said. It was her first glimpse of eastern atmosphere and color. "I can't tell you how happy I am," she declared to Quest, "to think that this voyage is over. Every night I have gone to bed terrified." He smiled grimly. "Things have been quiet enough the last few days," he said. "There's Harris on this barge. Look at Laura waving to him." The Scotland Yard man only glanced up at them. He was occupied in leaning over towards Laura, who was on the deck below. "If you said the word," he called out, "I wouldn't be going back, Miss Laura. I'd stick to the ship fast enough." She laughed at him gaily. "Not you. You're longing for your smoky old London already. You cut it out, my friend. You're a good sort, and I hope we'll meet again some day. But..." She shook her head at him good-humoredly. He turned away, disappointed, and waved his hand to Lenora and Quest on the upper deck. "Coming on shore, any of you?" he inquired. "We may when the boat moves up," Quest replied. "The professor went off on the first barge. Here he is coming back." A little boat had shot out from the docks, manned by a couple of Arabs. They could see the professor seated in the stern. He was poring over a small document which he held in his hand. He waved to them excitedly. "He's got news," Quest muttered. With much shouting, the boat was brought to the side of the barge. The professor was hauled up. He stumbled blindly across towards the gangway and came up the steps with amazing speed. He came straight to Quest and Lenora and gripped the former by the arm. "Look," he cried, "look." He held out a card. Quest read it aloud. "There is not one amongst you with the wit of a Mongar child. Goodbye. The hands." "Where did you get it?" Quest demanded. "That's the point, the whole point," the professor exclaimed excitedly. "He's done us. He's landed. The paper was pushed into my hand by a tall Arab who mumbled something and hurried off across the docks. On the landing stage, mind." The captain came and put his head out of the door. "Mr. Quest," he said, "can you spare me a moment? You can all come if you like." They had moved up towards him. The captain closed the door of his cabin. He pointed to a carpet sweeper which lay against the wall. "Look at that," he invited. They lifted the top. Inside were several sandwiches and a small can of tea. "What on earth is this?" Quest demanded. The captain, without a word, led them into his inner room. A huge lounge stood in one corner. He lifted the valance. Underneath were some crumbs.
"You see," he pointed out, "there's room there for a man to have hidden, especially if he could crawl out on deck at night." I couldn't make out why the Dickens Brown was always sweeping out my room, and I took up this thing a little time ago and looked at it. This is what I found. "Where's Brown?" Quest asked quickly. "I rang down for the chief steward," the captain continued, "and ordered Brown to be sent up at once. The chief steward came himself instead. It seems Brown went off without his wages, but with a huge parcel of bedding on the first bars this morning, before anyone was about." Quest groaned as he turned away. "Captain," he declared, "I'm ashamed. He has been here all the time, and we have let him slip through our fingers. Girls," he went on briskly, turning towards Laura, who had just come up, "India's off. We'll catch this barge if there's time. Our luggage can be put on shore when the boat docks." The captain walked gloomily with them to the gangway. "I shall miss you all," he told Laura. She laughed in his face. "If you ask me, I think you'll be glad to be rid of us." "Not of you, Miss Laura," he insisted. She made a little grimace. "You're as bad as Mr. Harris," she declared. "We'll come for another trip with you some day." They left him leaning disconsolately over the rails. The professor and Quest sat side by side on one of the trunks which was piled upon the barge. "Professor," Quest asked, "how long would it take us to get to this Mongard village you spoke about?"
"Two or three days, if we can get camels," the other replied. "I see you agree with me, then, as to Craig's probable destination."
Quest nodded. "What sort of fellows are they, anyway?" he asked. "Will it be safe for us to push on alone?"
"With me," the professor assured him, "you will be safe anywhere. I speak a little of their language. I have lived with them. They are far more civilized than some of the interior tribes."
"We'll find a comfortable hotel where we can leave the girls," Quest began.
"You can cut that out," Laura interrupted. "I don't know about the kid here, but if you think I'm going to miss a camel ride across the desert, you are dead wrong, so that's all there is to it."
Quest glanced toward Lenora. She leaned over and took his arm. "I simply couldn't be left behind," she pleaded. "I've had quite enough of that."
"The journey will not be an unpleasant one," the professor declared amiably, "and riding on a camel is an accomplishment easily acquired. So far as I'm aware, too, the district which we will have to traverse is entirely peaceable." They disembarked and were driven to the hotel, still discussing their project. Afterwards, they all wandered into the bazaars, along the narrow streets, where dusky children pulled at their clothes and ran by their side, and where every now and then a brown-skinned Arab on a slow-moving camel made his way through the throngs of veiled Turkish women, Syrians, Arabs, and Egyptians. Laura and Lenora, at any rate, attracted by the curious novelty of the scene, forgot the heat, the street smells, and the filthy clothes of the mendicants and loafers who pressed against them. They bought strange jewelry, shawls, beads, and perfumes. The professor disappeared for some time, but rejoined them later.
"It's all arranged," he announced. "I have found a dragon man whom I know. We shall have four of the best camels and a small escort ready to start tomorrow morning. Furthermore, I have news. An Englishman, whose description precisely tallies with Craig's, started off only an hour ago in the same direction. This time, at any rate, Craig cannot escape us."
"He might go on past the Mongar camp," Quest suggested.
The professor shook his head. "The Mongar village," he explained, "is placed practically at a cul-de-sac so far as regards further progress southward without making a detour. It is flanked by a strip of jungle and desert on either side.
in which there are no wells for many miles. We shall find Craig with the Mongars." They made their way back to the hotel, dined in a cool, bare room, and sauntered again out into the streets. The professor led the way to a little building, outside which a man was volubly inviting all to enter. "You shall see one of the sights of Port Said," he promised. "This is a real Egyptian dancing girl." They took their seats in the front row of a dimly lit, bare-looking room. The stage was dark and empty. From some unseen place came the monotonous rhythm of a single instrument. They waited for some time in vain. At last, one or two lights in front were lit. The music grew more insistent. A girl, who seemed to be dressed in little more than a winding veil, glided out onto the stage, swaying and moving slowly to the rhythm of the monotonous music. She danced a measure which none of them, except the professor, had ever seen before, coming now and then so close that they could almost feel her hot breath, and Lenora felt somehow vaguely disturbed by the glitter of her eyes. An odd perfume was shaken into the air around them from one of her flowing garments, through which her limbs continually flashed. Lenora looked away. "I don't like it," she said to Quest simply. Suddenly Laura leaned forward. "Look at the professor," she whispered. They all turned their heads. A queer change seemed to have come into the professor's face. His teeth were gleaming between his parted lips. His head was a little thrust forward. His eyes were filled with a strange, hard light. He was a transformed being, unrecognizable, perturbing. Even while they watched, the girl floated close to where he sat and leaned towards him with a queer, mocking smile. His hand suddenly descended upon her foot. She laughed still more. There was a little exclamation from Lenora. The professor, whose frame quivered, snatched the anklet from the girl's ankle and bent over it. She leaned towards him, a torrent of words streaming from her lips. The professor answered her in her own language. She listened to him in amazement. The anger passed. She held out both her hands. The professor still argued. She shook her head. Finally, he placed some gold in her palms. She patted him on the cheek, laughed into his eyes, pointed behind, and resumed her dancing. The anklet remained in the professor's hand. "Say, we'll get out of this," Quest said. "The girls have had enough." The professor made no objection. He led the way, holding the anklet all the time close to his eyes and turning it round. They, none of them, spoke to him. Yet they were all conscious of an immense sense of relief when, after they had passed into the street, he commenced to talk in his natural voice. "Congratulate me," he said. "I have been a collector of Assyrian gold ornaments all my life. This is the one anklet I needed to complete my collection. It has the double mark of the pharaohs. I recognized it at once. There are a thousand like it, you would think, in the bazaars there. In reality, there may be, perhaps, a dozen more in all Egypt which are genuine." They all looked at one another. Their relief had grown too poignant for words. "Early start tomorrow," Quest reminded them. "Home in bed for me this moment," Laura declared. "The camels," the professor assented, "will be round at daybreak." Lenora, a few nights later, looked down from the star-strewn sky, which seemed suddenly to have dropped so much nearer to them, to the shadows thrown across the desert by the dancing flames of their fire. "It is the same world, I suppose," she murmured. "A queer little place out of the same world," Quest agreed. "Listen to those fellows, how they chatter." The camel drivers and guides were sitting together in a little group some distance away. They had finished their supper and were chattering together now, swaying back and forth, two of them at least in a state of wild excitement. "Whatever can they be talking about?" Laura asked. "They sound as though they were going to fight every second." The professor smiled. "The last one was talking about the beauty of his fat lady friend," he remarked dryly. "Just before, they were discussing whether they would be given any backsheesh in addition to their pay. We are quite off the ordinary routes here, and these fellows aren't much use to Europeans." Laura rose to her feet. "I'm going to get a drink," she announced. The dragon man, who had been hovering around, bowed gravely and pointed toward the water bottles. Lenora also rose. "I'm coming too," she decided. "It seems a sin to think of going to sleep, though. The whole place is like a great silent sea. I suppose this isn't a dream, is it, Laura?" "There's no dream about my thirst, anyway," Laura declared. She took the horn cup from the dragon man. "Have some yourself if you want to, Hassan," she invited. Hassan bowed gravely, filled a cup, and drank it off. He stood for a moment perfectly still, as though something were coming over him, which he failed to understand. Then his lips parted. His eyes, for a moment, seemed to shoot out of his dusky skin. He threw up his arms and fell over on his side. Laura, who had only sipped her cup, threw it from her. She, too, reeled for a moment. The professor and Quest came running up, attracted by Lenora's shriek. "They're poisoned," she cried. "The Videmsu," Quest shouted. "My God, pull yourself together, Laura. Hold up for a minute." He dashed back to their little encampment and reappeared almost immediately. He threw Laura's head back and forced some liquid down her throat. "It's camphor," he cried. "You'll be all right, Laura. Hold on to yourself." He swung round to where the dragon man was lying. Forced his mouth open, but it was too late. The man was dead. He returned to Laura. She stumbled to her feet. She was pale, and drops of perspiration were standing on her forehead. She was able to rise to her feet, however, without assistance. "I'm all right now," she declared. Quest felt her pulse and her forehead. They moved back to the fire. "We are within a dozen miles or so of the Mongar village," Quest said grimly. "Do you suppose that fellow could have been watching?" They all talked together for a time in low voices. The professor was inclined to scout the theory of Craig having approached them. "You must remember," he pointed out, "that the Mongars hate these fellows. It was part of my arrangement with Hassan that they should leave us when we got in sight of the Mongar encampment. It may have been meant for Hassan. The Mongars hate the dragon men who bring tourists in this direction at all." They talked a little while longer and finally stole away to their tents to sleep. Outside, the camel drivers talked still, chattering away, walking now and then around Hassan's body in solemn procession. Finally, one of them, who seemed to have taken the lead, broke into an impassioned stream of words. The others listened. When he had finished, there was a low murmur of fierce approval. Silent-footed, as though shod in velvet, they ran to the tethered camels, stacked provisions once more upon their backs, lashed the guns across their own shoulders. Soon they stole away, a long ghostly procession into the night. "Those fellows seem to have left off their infernal chattering all of a sudden," Quest remarked lazily from inside the tent. The professor made no answer. He was asleep. End of chapter 11, part 2.
Chapter 12, part 1 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. A Desert Vengeance, Part 1. Quest was the first the next morning to open his eyes, to grope his way through the tent opening
and stand for a moment alone, watching the alabaster skies. Away eastward, the faint curve of the blood-red sun seemed to be rising out of the limitless sea of sand. The light around him was pearly, almost opalescent, fading eastwards into pink. The shadows had passed away. Though the sands were still hot beneath his feet, the silent air was deliciously cool. He turned lazily around, meaning to summon the Arab who had volunteered to take Hassan's place. His arms, he had been in the act of stretching, fell to his sides. He stared incredulously at the spot where the camels had been tethered. There were no camels, no drivers, no Arabs. There was not a soul nor an object in sight except the stark body of Hassan, which they had dragged half out of sight behind a slight knoll. High up in the sky above were two little black specks, wheeling lower and lower. Quest shivered as he suddenly realized that for the first time in his life he was looking upon the winged ghouls of the desert. Lower and lower they came. He turned away with a shiver. The professor was still sleeping when Quest re-entered the tent. He woke him up and beckoned him to come outside. "Dear me," the former exclaimed genially, as he adjusted his glasses. "I am not sure that my toilet, however, the young ladies, I imagine, are not yet astir." "You did well to call me, Quest. This is the rose dawn of Egypt. I have watched it from the solitudes, such as you have never dreamed of. After all, we are here scarcely past the outskirts of civilization." "You'll find we are far enough," Quest remarked grimly. "What do you make of this, Professor?" He pointed to the little sandy knoll with its sparse covering of grass, deserted, with scarcely a sign, even, that it had been the resting place of the caravan. The professor gave vent to a little exclamation. "Our guides," he demanded, "and the camels, what has become of them?" "I woke you up to ask you that question," Quest replied, "but I guess it's pretty obvious. We might have saved the money we gave for those rifles in Port Said." The professor hurried off toward the spot where the encampment had been made. Suddenly, he stood still and pointed with his finger. In the clearer, almost crystalline light of the coming day, they saw the tracks of the camels in one long, unbroken line stretching away northwards. No river near where they could have gone to water the camels or anything of that sort, I suppose? Quest asked. The professor smiled. "Nothing nearer than a little stream you may have heard of in the days when you studied geography," he observed derisively. "The Nile. I never liked the looks of those fellows, Quest. They sat and talked and crooned together after Hassan's death. I felt that they were up to some mischief." He glanced around a little helplessly. Quest took a cigar from his case and lit it. "To think that an old campaigner like I am," the professor continued, in a tone of abasement, "should be placed in a position like this. There have been times when, for weeks together, I have slept literally with my finger upon the trigger of my rifle, when I have laid warning traps in case the natives tried to desert in the night. I have even had our pack ponies hobbled. I have learned the secret of no end of devices. And here, with a shifty lot of Arabs picked up in the slums of Port Said, and Hassan, the dragon man, dying in that mysterious fashion, I permit myself to lie down and go to sleep. I do not even secure my rifle. Quest, I shall never forgive myself." "No good worrying," Quest sighed. "The question is, how best to get out of the mess? What's the next move, anyway?" The professor glanced towards the sun and took a small compass out of his pocket. He pointed across the desert. "That's exactly our route," he said, "but I reckon we still must be 2 days from the Mongars, and how we are going to get there ourselves
Much more get the women there without camels, I don't know. There are no wells, and I don't believe those fellows have left us a single tin of water.
Any chance of falling in with a caravan? Quest inquired.
Not one in 100, the professor replied gloomily. If we were only the short distance out of Port Said and on one of the recognized trade routes, we should probably meet half a dozen before midday. Here we are simply in the wilds. The way we are going leads to nowhere and finishes in an utterly uninhabitable jungle.
Think we better turn round and try to bisect one of the trade routes? Quest suggested.
The professor shook his head. We should never know when we've struck it. There are no milestones or telegraph wires. We shall have to put as brave a face on it as possible and push on.
Laura put her head out of the tent in which the two women had slept.
Say, where's breakfast? She exclaimed. I can't smell the coffee. They turned and approached her silently. The two girls, fully dressed, came out of the tent as they approached.
Young ladies, the professor announced, I regret to say that a misfortune has befallen us, a misfortune which we shall be able, without a doubt, to surmount, but which will mean a day of hardship and much inconvenience.
Where are the camels? Lenora asked breathlessly.
Gone, Quest replied.
And the Arabs?
Gone with them. We are left high and dry, Quest explained. Those fellows are as superstitious as they can be, and Hassan's death has given them the scares. They have gone back to Port Said.
And what is worse, the professor added with a groan, they have taken with them all of our stores, our rifles, and our water.
How far are we from the Mongar camp? Lenora asked.
About a day's tramp, Quest replied quickly. We may reach there by nightfall.
Then let's start walking at once before it gets any hotter, Lenora suggested.
Quest patted her on the back. They made a close search of the tents, that the Arabs had taken everything in the way of food and drink except a single half-filled tin of drinking water.
They moistened their lips with this carefully, Quest, with a camphor in his hand.
They found it good, however, though lukewarm. Laura produced a packet of sweet chocolate from her pocket.
It's some breakfast, this, she remarked, as she handed it round.
Let's get a move on.
And if I may be permitted to make a suggestion, the professor advised, not too much chocolate. It's sustaining, I know, but this sweetened concoction encourages thirst, and it is thirst from which we may suffer most inconvenience.
1, 2, 3, march, Laura sung out. Come on, everybody.
They started bravely enough, but by midday, their little stock of water had gone, and their feet were sorely blistered. No one complained, however, and the professor especially did his best to revive their spirits.
We have come further than I had dared to hope in the time, he announced. Fortunately, I know the exact direction we must take. Keep up your spirits, young ladies. At any time now, we may see signs of our destination.
Makes one sad to think of the drinks we could have had, Quest muttered.
What's that?
The whole party stopped short. Before them was a distant vision of white houses, of little stunted groves of trees, the masts of ship in the distance.
It's Port Said, Quest exclaimed.
What the mischief?
As we turned round, say, Professor, has your compass got the jim-jams?
I don't care where it is, Lenora faltered with tears in her eyes. I thought Port Said was a horrible place, but just now I believe it's heaven.
The professor turned toward them and shook his head.
Can't you see, he pointed out, it's a mirage, a desert mirage. They are quite common at dusk.
Lenore, for a moment, was hysterical, and even Laura gave a little sob. Quest set his teeth and glanced at the professor. "Always water near when there's a mirage, isn't there, Professor?" "That's so," the professor agreed. "We are coming to something, all right." They struggled on once more. Night came, and brought with it a half-soothing, half-torturing coolness. The vain straining of the eyes upon the horizon, at any rate, was spared to them. They slept in a fashion, but soon after dawn, they were on their feet again. They were silent now, for their tongues were swollen, and talk had become painful. Their walk had become a shamble, but there was one expression in their haggard faces common to all of them, the brave, dogged desire to struggle on to the last. Suddenly Quest, who had gone a little out of his way to mount a low ridge of sand hills, waved his arms furiously. He was holding his field glasses to his eyes. It was wonderful how that ray of hope transformed them. They hurried to where he was. He passed the glasses to the professor. "A caravan," he exclaimed. "I can see the camels and the horses." The professor almost snatched the glasses. "It is quite true," he agreed. "It is a caravan crossing at right angles to our direction. Come, they will see us before long." Lenora began to sob and Laura to laugh. Both were struggling with a tendency towards hysterics. The professor and Quest marched grimly side by side. With every step they took, the caravan became more distinct. Presently, three or four horsemen detached themselves from the main body and came galloping towards them. The eyes of the little party glistened as they saw that the foremost had a water bottle slung around his neck. He came dashing up, waving his arms. "You lost people," he asked. "Want water?" They almost snatched the bottle from him. It was like pouring life into their veins. They all, at the professor's instigation, drank sparingly. Quest, with a great sigh of relief, lit a cigar. "Some adventure this," he declared. The professor, who had been talking to the men in their own language, turned back towards the two girls. "It is a caravan," he explained, "of peaceful merchants on their way to Haifa. They are halting for us, and we shall be able, without a doubt, to arrange for water and food and a camel or two horses. The man here asks if the ladies will take the horses and ride." They started off gaily to where the caravan had come to a standstill. They had scarcely traversed 100 yards, however, before the Arab, who was leading Lenora's horse, came to a sudden standstill. He pointed with his arm and commenced to talk in an excited fashion to his two companions. From across the desert, facing them, came a little company of horsemen, galloping fast and with the sunlight flashing upon their rifles. "The Mongars," the Arab cried, pointing wildly. "They attack the caravan." The three Arabs talked together for a moment in excited fashion. Then, without excuse or warning, they swung the two women to the ground, leaped on their horses, and, turning northwards, galloped away. Already the crack of the rifles and little puffs of white smoke showed where the Mongars, advancing cautiously, were commencing their attack. The professor looked on anxiously. "I am not all at sure," he said in an undertone to Quest, "about our position with the Mongars. Craig has a peculiar hold upon them, but as a rule they hate white men, and their blood will be up. See, the fight is all over. Those fellows were no match for the Mongars. Most of them have fled and left the caravan." The fight was indeed over, for the Mongars had galloped away in pursuit of the Arabs, who had been the temporary escort of Quest and his companions. They passed about 100 yards away, waving their arms and shouting furiously. One of them even fired a shot, which missed Quest by only a few inches. "They say they are coming back," the professor muttered. "Who's this?" "It's the chief, and..."
"Our search is over at any rate," Quest interrupted. "It's Craig."
They came galloping up, Craig in white linen clothes and an Arab cloak, the chief by his side, a fine upright man with long gray beard. Behind three Mongars, the rifles already to their shoulders, the chief wheeled up his horse as he came within 20 paces of the little party.
"White English," he shouted. "Why do you seek death here?"
He waited for no reply, but turned to his men. Three of them dashed forward, their rifles, which were fitted with an odd sort of bayonet, drawn back for the plunge. Quest, snatching his field glasses from his shoulder, swung them by the strap above his head and brought them down upon the head of his assailant. The man reeled, and his rifle fell from his hand. Quest picked it up and stood on guard. The other two Mongars swung round towards him, raising their rifles to their shoulders. Quest held Lenora to him. It seemed as though their last second had come. Suddenly Craig, who had been a little in the rear, galloped, shouting into the line of fire.
"Stop," he ordered. "Chief, these people are my friends. Chief, the word..."
The chief raised his arm promptly. The men lowered their rifles, and Craig galloped back to his host's side. The chief listened to him, nodding gravely. Presently, he rode up to the little party. He saluted the professor and talked to him in his own language. The professor turned to the others.
"The chief apologizes for not recognizing me," he announced. "It seems that Craig has told him that he had come to the desert for shelter, and he imagined at once, when he gave the order for the attack upon us, that we were his enemies. He says that we are welcome to go with him to his encampment."
Quest stood for a moment irresolute.
"Seems to me we're in a pretty fix," he muttered. "We've got to owe our lives to that fellow Craig. Anyway, how shall we be able to get him away from them? Goodness only knows."
"That is for later," the professor said gravely. "At present, I think we cannot do better than accept the hospitality of the chief. Even now, the chief is suspicious. I heard him ask Craig why, if these were his friends, he did not greet them."
Craig turned slowly towards them. It was a strange meeting. His face was thin and worn. There were hollows in his cheeks, a dull light in his sunken eyes. He had the look of a hunted animal. He spoke to them in a low tone.
"It is necessary," he told them, "that you should pretend to be my friends. The chief has ordered two of his men to dismount. Their ponies are for the young ladies. There will be horses for you amongst the captured ones from the caravan yonder."
"So we meet at last, Craig," the professor said sternly.
Craig raised his eyes and dropped them again. He said nothing. He turned instead once more towards Quest.
"Whatever there may be between us," he said, "your lives are mine at this moment, if I choose to take them. For the sake of the women, do as I advise. The chief invites you to his encampment as his guests." They all turned towards the chief, who remained a little on the outside of the circle. The professor raised his hat and spoke a few words in his own language. Then he turned to the others.
"I have accepted the invitation of the chief," he announced. "We had better start."
"This may not be Delmonico's," Laura remarked a few hours later, with a little sigh of contentment. "But believe me, that goat stew and sherbet tasted better than any chicken and champagne I ever tasted." "And I don't quite know what tobacco this is," Quest added, helping himself to one of the little pile of cigarettes which had been brought in to them, "but it tastes good." They moved to the opening of the tent and sat looking out across the silent desert. Laura took the flap of canvas in her hand. "What do all these marks mean?" she asked. "They are cabalistic signs," the professor replied, "part of the language of the tribe. They indicate that this is the guest tent, and there are a few little maxims traced upon it, extolling the virtues of hospitality. Out in the desert there, we met the Mongars as foes, and we had, I can assure you, a very narrow escape of our lives. Here, under the shelter of their encampment, it is a very different matter. We have eaten their salt." "It's a strange position," Quest remarked moodily. Lenore leaned forward to where a little group of Mongars were talking together. "I wish that beautiful girl would come and let us see her again," she murmured. "She," the professor explained, "is the chief's daughter, Frida, whose life Craig saved." "And from the way she looks at him," Laura observed, "I should say she hadn't forgotten it either." The professor held up a warning finger. The girl herself had glided to their side out of the shadows. She faced the professor. The rest of the party she seemed to ignore. She spoke very slowly and in halting English. "My father wishes to know that you are satisfied," she said. "You have no further wants?" "None," the professor assured her. "We are very grateful for this hospitality, Frida." "Won't you talk to us for a little time?" Lenora begged, leaning forward. The girl made no responsive movement. She seemed, if anything, to shrink a little away. Her head was thrown back. Her dark eyes were filled with dislike. She turned suddenly to the professor and spoke to him in her own language. She pointed to the signs upon the tent, drew her finger along one of the sentences, flashed a fierce glance at them all, and disappeared. "Seems to me we are not exactly popular with the young lady," Quest remarked. "What was she saying, Professor?" "She suspects us," the professor said slowly, "of wishing to bring evil to Craig." She pointed to a sentence upon the tent. "Roughly it means, gratitude is the debt of hospitality. I am very much afraid that the young lady must have been listening to our conversation a while ago." Lenora shivered. "To think of any girl," she murmured, "caring for a fiend like Craig." Before they knew it, she was there again, her eyes on fire, her tone shaking. "You call him evil, he who saved your lives, who saved you from the swords of my soldiers," she cried. "I wish that you had all died before you came here. I hope that you yet may die." She passed away into the night. The professor looked anxiously after her. "It's a humiliating reflection," he said, "but we are most certainly in Craig's power. Until we have been able to evolve some scheme for liberating ourselves and taking him with us, if possible, I think that we had better avoid any reference to him as much as possible. The young woman is quite capable of stirring up the whole tribe against us. The whole onus of hospitality would pass if they suspected we meant evil to Craig, and they have an ugly way of dealing with their enemies. Ah, listen." The professor suddenly leaned forward. There was a queer change in his face. From somewhere, on the other side of that soft bank of violet darkness, came what seemed to be the clear, low cry of some animal. "It is the Mongar cry of warning," he said hoarsely. "Something is going to happen." The whole encampment was suddenly in a state of activity. The Mongars ran hither and thither, getting together their horses. The chief, with Craig by his side, was standing on the outskirts of the camp. The cry came again, this time much louder and nearer. Soon they caught the muffled trampling of a horse's hoofs, galloping across the soft sands. Then the gleam of his white garments as he came suddenly into sight in the edge of the little circle of light thrown by the fire. They saw him leap from his horse, run to the chief, bend double in some form of salute, then commence to talk rapidly. The chief listened with no sign of emotion, but in a moment or two he was giving rapid orders. Camels appeared from some invisible place. Men, already on horseback, were galloping hither and thither, collecting firearms and spare ammunition. Pack horses were being loaded, tents rolled up, and every evidence of breaking camp. "Seems to me there's a move on," Quest muttered, as they rose to their feet. "I wonder if we are in it." A moment or two later, Craig approached them. He came with his shoulders stooped and his eyes fixed upon the ground. He scarcely raised them as he spoke. "Word has been brought to the chief," he announced, "that the Arab who escaped from the caravan has fallen in with an outpost of British soldiers. They have already started in pursuit of us. The Mongars will take refuge in the jungle, where they have prepared hiding places. We start at once." "What about us?" the professor inquired. "I endeavored," Craig continued, "to persuade the chief to allow you to remain here when the care of you would devolve upon the English soldiers. He and Frieda, however, have absolutely refused my request. Frieda has overheard some of your conversation, and the chief believes that you will betray us. You will have to come along, too." "You mean," Laura exclaimed, "that we've got to tramp into what you call the jungle and hide there because these thieves are being chased?" Craig glanced uneasily around. "Young lady," he said, "you will do well to speak little here. They have long ears and quick understanding, these men. You may call them a race of robbers. They only remember that they are the descendants of an imperial race, and what they take by the right of conquest, they believe Allah sends them. You must do the bidding of the chief." He turned away to where the chief and Frieda, already on horseback, were waiting for him. Quest leaned towards the professor. "Why not tackle the chief yourself?" he suggested. "Here he comes now. Craig may be speaking the truth, but, on the other hand, it's all to his interest to keep us away from the soldiers." The professor rose at once to his feet and stepped out to where the chief was giving orders. "Chief," he said, "my friends desire me to speak with you. We are worn out with our adventures. The young ladies who are with us are unused to and ill-prepared for this hard life. We beg that you will allow us to remain here and await the arrival of the English soldiers." The chief turned his head. There was little friendliness in his tone. "Wise man," he replied, "I have sent you my bidding by him who is our honored guest. I tell you frankly that I am not satisfied with the explanations I have received of your presence here." Frieda leaned forward, her beautiful eyes flashing in the dim light.
"Ah, but I know," she cried.
"They would bring harm to the master. I can read it in their hearts as I have heard it from their own lips." "What my daughter says is truth," the chief declared. "Back, wise man. Tell your friends that you ride with us tonight, either as guests or captives. You may take your choice." The professor returned to where the others were eagerly awaiting him. "It is useless," he announced. "The girl who is clearly enamored of Craig suspects us. So does the chief. Perhaps secretly, Craig himself is unwilling to leave us here. The chief never changes his mind, and he has spoken. We go either as his captives or his guests. I have heard it said," the professor added grimly, "that the Mongars never keep captives longer than 24 hours. They all rose at once to their feet, and a few moments later, horses were brought. The little procession was already being formed in line. Craig approached them once more. "You will mount now and ride in the middle of our caravan," he directed. "The chief does not trust you. If you value your lives, you will do as you are bidden." "I don't like the idea of the jungle," Lenora sighed. "Gives me the creeps," Laura admitted, as she climbed upon her horse. "Any wild animals there, Professor?" The professor became more cheerful. "The animal life of the region we are about to traverse," he observed, as they moved off, "is in some respect familiar to me. 12 years ago, I devoted some time to research a little to the westward of our present route. I will, if you choose, as we ride, give you a brief account of some of my discoveries." The two girls exchanged glances. Quest, who had intercepted them, turned his horse and rode in between the professor and Lenora. "Go right ahead, Professor," he invited. "Fortunately, the girls have got saddles like boxes, and I think they both mean to go to sleep." "An intelligent listener of either sex," the professor said amiably, "will be a stimulus to my memory." End of chapter 12, part 1.
Chapter 12, part 2 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. A Desert Vengeance, part 2. "You can call this fairyland if you want," Laura remarked, gazing around her. "I call it a nasty, damp, oozy spot." "It seemed very beautiful when we first came," Lenora sighed. "But that was after the heat and glare of the desert. There does seem something a little unhealthy about it." "I'm just fed up with the Mongars," Quest declared. "We do nothing but lie about, and they won't even let us fire a gun off." "Personally," the professor confessed, holding up a glass bottle in front of him, from which a yellow beetle was making frantic efforts to escape, "I find this little patch of country unusually interesting. The specimen, which I have here, I spare you the scientific name for him, belongs to a class of beetle which has for long eluded me." Laura regarded the specimen with disfavor. "So far as I'm concerned," she observed, "I shouldn't have cared if he eluded you a little longer. Don't you dare let him out, Professor." "My dear young lady," the professor assured her, "the insect is perfectly secure. Through the cork, as you can see, I have bored a couple of holes, hoping to keep him alive until we reach Port Said, where I can prepare him as a specimen." "Port Said," Lenora murmured. "It sounds like heaven." Quest motioned them to sit a little nearer. "Well," he said, "I fancy we're all feeling about the same, except the professor, and even he wants to get some powder for his beetle. I had a moment's talk with Craig this morning, and from what he says, I fancy they mean to make a move a little further in before long. It'll be all the more difficult to escape then." "You think we could get away?" Lenora whispered eagerly. Quest glanced cautiously around. They were surrounded by thick vegetation, but they were only a very short distance from the camp. "Seems to me," he continued, "we shall have to try it some day or other, and I'm all for trying it soon. Even if they caught us, I don't believe they'd dare kill us, with the English soldiers so close behind. I am going to get hold of two or three rifles and some ammunition. That's easy, because they leave them about all the time. And what you girls want to do is to hide some food and get a bottle of water." "What about Craig?" the professor asked. "We're going to take him along," Quest declared grimly. "He's had the devil's own luck so far, but it can't last forever. I'll see to that part of the business. If you others get ready and wait for me to give the signal..." "What's that?"
They all looked around. There had been a little rustling amongst the canopy of bushes. Quest peered through and returned frowning. "Frieda again," he muttered. "She hangs around all the time, trying to listen to what we are saying. She couldn't have heard this, though. Now, girls, remember, when the food is about this evening, see how much you could get hold of. I know just where to find the guns and the horses. Let's separate now. The professor and I will go on a beetle hunt." They dispersed in various directions. It was not until late in the evening, when the Mongars had withdrawn a little to indulge in their customary orgy of crooning songs, that they were absolutely alone. Quest looked out of the tent in which they had been sitting and came back again. "Well?" Laura lifted her skirt and showed an unusual projection underneath. "Lenore and I have pinned up our petticoats," she announced. "We've got plenty of food and a bottle of water." Quest threw open the white Arab cloak which he had been wearing. He had three rifles strapped around him. "The professor's got the ammunition," he said, "and we've five horses tethered 100 paces along the track we came by, just behind the second tree turning to the left. I want you all to go there now at once and take the rifles. There isn't a soul in the camp, and you can carry them wrapped in this cloak. I'll join you in 10 minutes. "What about Craig?" the professor inquired. "I'm seeing to him," Quest replied. Lenora hesitated. "Isn't it rather a risk?" she whispered fearfully. Quest's face was suddenly stern. "Craig is going back with us," he said. "I'll be careful, Lenora. Don't worry." He strolled out of the tent and came back again. "The coast clear," he announced. "Off you go." "One moment," he added. "There are some papers in this little box of mine which one of you ought to take care of." He bent hastily over the little wallet, which never left him. Suddenly, a little exclamation broke from his lips. The professor peered over his shoulder. "What is it?" Quest never said a word. From one of the spaces of the wallet, he drew out a small black box, removed the lid, and held out the card. They read it together. "Fools, all of you! The cunning of the ages defeats your puny efforts at every turn. The hands." Even the professor's lips blanched a little as he read. Quest, however, seemed suddenly furious. He tore the card and the box into pieces, flung them into a corner of the tent, and drew a revolver from his pocket. "This time," he exclaimed, "we are going to make an end to the hands. Out you go now, girls. You can leave me to finish things up." One by one, they stole along the path. Quest came out and watched them disappear. Then he gripped his revolver firmly in his hand and turned towards Craig's tent. There was something in the breathless stillness of the place at that moment which seemed almost a presage of coming disaster. Without knowing exactly why, Quest's fingers tightened on the butt of his weapon. Then, from the thick growth by the side of the clearing, he saw a dark shape steal out and vanish in the direction of Craig's tent. He came to a standstill, puzzled. There had been rumors of lions all day, but the professor had been incredulous. The nature of the country, he thought, scarcely favored the probability of their presence. Then the still heavy air was suddenly rent by a wild scream of horror. Across the narrow opening, the creature had reappeared, carrying something in its mouth, something which gave vent all the time to the most awful yells. Quest fired his revolver on chance and broke into a run. Already the Mongars, disturbed in their evening amusement, were breaking into the undergrowth in chase. Quest came to a standstill. It was from Craig's tent that the beast had issued. He turned slowly around. If Craig had indeed paid for his crimes by so horrible a death, there was all the more reason why they should make their escape in the general confusion, and make it quickly. He retraced his steps. The sound of shouting voices grew less and less distinct. When he reached the meeting place, he found the professor standing at the corner with the rest. His face showed signs of the most lively curiosity. "From the commotion," he announced, "I believe that, after all, a lion has visited the camp. The cries which we have heard were distinctly the cries of a native." Quest shook his head. "A lion's been here all right," he said, "and he has finished our little job for us. That was Craig. I saw him come out of Craig's tent." The professor was dubious. "My friend," he said, "you are mistaken. There is nothing more characteristic and distinct than the Magar cry of fear. They seldom use it except in the face of death. That was the cry of a native Mongar. As for Craig, well, you see, that tree that looks like a dwarf aloe?" Quest nodded. "What about it?" "Craig was lying there 10 minutes ago. He sprang up when he heard the yells from the encampment. But I believe he is there now." "Got the horses all right?" Quest inquired. "Everything is waiting," the professor replied. "I'll have one more try then," Quest declared. He made his way slowly through the undergrowth to the spot which the professor had indicated. Close to the trunk of a tree, Craig was standing. Frida was on her knees before him. She was speaking to him in broken English. "Dear master, you shall listen to your slave. These people are your enemies. It will be all over in a few minutes. You have but to say the word. My father is eager for it. No one would ever know." Craig patted her head. His tone was filled with the deepest despondency. "It's impossible, Frida," he said. "You do not understand. I cannot tell you everything. Sometimes I almost think the best thing I could do would be to return with them to the countries you know nothing of." "That's what you are going to do anyway," Quest declared suddenly, making his appearance. "Hands up." He covered Craig with his revolver, but his arms were scarcely extended before Frida sprang at him like a wild cat. He gripped her with his left arm and held her away with difficulty. "Craig," he continued, "you're coming with us. You know the way to Port Said, and we want you. You know why? Untie the sash from your waist quickly." Craig obeyed. He had the stupefied air of a man who had lost for the time his volition. "Tie it to the tree," Quest ordered. "Leave room enough." Craig did as he was told. Then he turned and held the loose ends up. Quest lowered his revolver for a moment as he pushed Frida towards it. Craig, with a wonderful spring, reached his side and kicked the revolver away. Before Quest could even stoop to recover it, he saw the glitter of the other's knife pressed against his chest. "Listen," Craig declared, "I've made up my mind. I won't go back to America. I've had enough of being hunted all over the world. This time I think I'll rid myself of one of you, at any rate." "Will you?" The interruption was so unexpected that Craig lost his nerve. Through the opening in the trees, only a few feet away, Lenora had suddenly appeared. She, too, held a revolver. Her hand was as steady as a rock. "Drop your knife," she ordered Craig. He obeyed without hesitation. "Now, tie the sash around the girl." He obeyed mechanically. Frida, who had been fiercely resisting Quest's effort to hold her, yielded without a struggle as soon as Craig touched her. She looked at him, however, with bitter reproach. "You would tie me here," she murmured. "You would leave me?" "It's fate," Craig muttered. "I am worn out without trying to escape, Frida. They will come soon and release you." She opened her lips to shriek, but Quest, who had made a gag of her linen headdress, thrust it suddenly into her mouth. He took Craig by the collar and led him to the spot where the others were waiting. They hoisted him onto a horse. Already behind them, they could see the flare of torches from the returning Mongars.
"You know the way to Port Said," Quest whispered. "See that you lead us there. There will be trouble, mind, if you don't."
Craig made no reply. He rode off in front of the little troop, covered all the time by Quest's revolver. Very soon, they were out of the jungle and in the open desert. Quest looked behind him uneasily.
"To judge by the row those fellows are making," he remarked, "I should think that they've found Frieda already."
"In that case," the professor said gravely, "let me recommend you to push on as fast as possible. We have had one escape from them, but nothing in the world can save us now that you have laid hands upon Frieda. The chief would never forgive that."
"We've got a start anyway," Quest observed, "and these are the five best horses in the camp. Girls, a little faster. We've got to trust Craig for the direction, but I believe he is right."
"So far as my instincts tell me," the professor agreed, "I believe that we are heading precisely in the right direction."
They galloped steadily on. The moon rose higher and higher until it became almost as light as day. Often, the professor raised himself in his saddle and peered forward.
"The column of soldiers would march at night," he remarked. "I am hoping all the time that we may meet them."
Quest fell a little behind to his side, although he never left off watching Craig.
"Look behind you, Professor," he whispered.
In the far distance were a number of little black specks, growing every moment larger. Even at that moment, they heard the low, long call of the Mongars.
"They're gaining on us," Quest muttered.
The two girls, white though they were, bent over their horses.
"We'll stick to it to the last moment," Quest continued.
"Then we'll turn and let them have it."
They raced on for another mile or more. A bullet whistled over their heads. Quest tightened his reins.
"No good," he sighed. "We'd better stay and fight it out, Professor."
"Stick close to me, Lenora."
They drew up and hastily dismounted. The Mongars closed in around them. A cloud had drifted in front of the moon, and in the darkness it was almost impossible to see their whereabouts. They heard the chief's voice.
"Shoot first that dog of a Craig."
There was a shriek. Suddenly Frieda, breaking loose from the others, raced across the little division. She flung herself from her horse.
"Tell my father that you are not faithless," she pleaded. "They shall not kill you."
She clung to Craig's neck. The bullets were beginning to whistle around them now. All of a sudden, she threw up her arms. Craig, in a fury, turned around and fired into the darkness. Then suddenly, as though on the bidding of some unspoken word, there was a queer silence. Everyone was distinctly conscious of an alien sound, the soft thud of many horses' feet galloping from the right. Then a sharp English voice of command.
"Hold your fire, men. Close in to the left there. Steady."
The cloud suddenly rolled away from the moon. A long line of horsemen were immediately visible. The officer in front rode forward.
"Drop your arms and surrender," he ordered sternly.
The Mongars, who were outnumbered by 20-1, obeyed without hesitation. Their chief seemed unconscious, even, of what had happened. He was on his knees, bending over the body of Frieda, half-supported in Craig's arms. The officer turned to Quest.
"Are you the party who left Port Said for the Mongar camp?" he asked.
Quest nodded.
"They took us into the jungle, just escaped. They caught us here, though, and I'm afraid we were about finished if you hadn't come along. We are not English, we're American."
"Same thing," the officer replied, as he held out his hand.
"Stack up their arms, men," he ordered, turning round. "Tie them in twos. Dennis,
Take the young ladies back to the commissariat camels." The professor drew a little sigh. "Commissariat," he murmured. "That sounds most inviting." End of chapter 12, part 2.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.